You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tig Enright, and on today's show...
The door is always open. If Russia changes its behaviour, if it allows the Ukrainian people to exercise their choice and their sovereignty and to decide their own future, these sanctions can go.
Well, that door might be open, but Vladimir Putin is staying in his bear cage. I'll be joined by John Everard and Robert Fox to hear their thoughts about Russia on the back foot. Also, that greater enemy of the West on the retreat, the Kurdish victory against Islamic State forces in northern Iraq. They'll also be taking us through their news highlights for 2014 and their forecast for next year's news. Also ahead, we check in with our woman in Sao Paulo to see what's making the news in Brazil, and in our film review, we'll chew the fat over new releases such as this.
How did we end up here? This place is horrible. Smells like balls.
This place is not horrible. This is Midori House. That's what's coming up with me, Tig Enright. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. Before all that, though, Paul Osborne has the news headlines.
The FBI says it's convinced North Korea was behind a cyber attack on a major movie studio. Investigators say analysis of the hacking attack does show links to the country. Sony Pictures withdrew The Interview, a comedy film about North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, after threats from hackers who had already released sensitive information taken from Sony. The White House has already described it as a serious national security matter. Richard Roper is the film critic of the Chicago Sun-Times newspaper.
If we give in to fear, the terrorists will have won. Rudy Giuliani, right after 9/11, was saying, come back to New York. We have to show our strength. FDR said it a million years ago. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And that's exactly what's happening today. I think this is really a very dark day, not just for the movie industry, but for America to give in like this.
Pakistan has reportedly carried out two executions days after lifting a moratorium on the death penalty. That decision followed the Taliban attack on a school in Peshawar, in which more than 140 people, almost all of them children, were killed. It's believed one of the two people executed was convicted of plotting to assassinate the former president, Pervez Musharraf, and the other over an attack on Pakistan's army headquarters 5 years ago. Prosecutors in Turkey have applied for an arrest warrant for a leading cleric and possible rival of the country's president. Fethullah Gülen had been living in self-imposed exile in the United States for 15 years. A one-time ally of the president, Tayyip Erdogan, he is now accused of seeking to overthrow him. Earlier this year, Mr. Erdogan said he planned to ask the US to extradite Mr. Gülen to stand trial in Turkey. Kurdish fighters in northern Iraq say they've achieved their biggest victory yet against Islamic State militants, breaking the siege of Mount Sinjar, where thousands of members of Iraq's Yazidi religious minority have been trapped for months. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters launched a new offensive backed by US airstrikes. The Pentagon claims a number of IS military leaders were killed. Australia's Prime Minister says the deaths of eight children in the far northeast of the country are heartbreaking. Their bodies were found at a house in Cairns. A woman, reportedly the mother of seven of the victims, is in hospital with serious injuries and is being questioned by police. In Cairns, a candlelit vigil was staged. Acting Superintendent Russell Miller is from the local police force.
It's devastating any time of the year. And obviously some of the police who were on the scene earlier are young junior officers, you know. So again, we're providing the support to them that they need as well from within our own systems.
Kenya's opposition says it will take legal action after the president signed new anti-terror measures interpreted by critics as a crackdown on freedom of speech. Uhuru Kenyatta has approved new laws which will allow suspects to be held without charge for almost a year. Kenya's opposition, the Coalition for Reforms and Democracy, says it will turn to the courts for protection. Its leader, Kalonzo Musyoka.
The Security Laws Amendment Act 2014 has created a militarized police state with unchecked and imperial presidential fiat. We have seen efforts by the state to brand all those questioning this law as unpatriotic and terrorism sympathizers. On the contrary, To be patriotic requires of the citizens to question the evil actions and intentions of the state.
Football's world governing body is to publish the full report into allegations of corruption in the bids to stage the next two World Cups. But FIFA says it will be a legally appropriate version, implying that many of the details will be excluded. Despite this, it is a significant move for FIFA, which had previously refused to release the full version of Michael Garcia's report into the corruption claims. He resigned earlier this week, saying FIFA was lacking judicial independence. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 if you're listening in New York. Well, join me now with their take on the day's news here in the studio. I'm joined by John Everard and Robert Fox. Welcome both of you back to Midori House. Let's start talking about Northern Iraq. We've seen today the most successful offensive to date in the region against Islamic State. Kurdish forces saying they've broken the militant group's siege of Mount Sinjar. Thousands of Yazidis had been displaced, and displaced Iraqis had been trapped there since the summer. Let me start by coming to you, Robert. Just how big a deal in the grand context of battling IS is this victory?
Well, it is symbolic. It's released the plight of the Yazidis, as you say. We're in terrible conditions. And they're a minority. They're a minority in many, many respects. They're largely Kurdish, but they have a broad spectrum of the very minority religions, including Zoroastrianism. That's why it's these people who are suffering so badly there. So that is significant. But in grand strategy, as you were saying, there are the big ones. Yes, at last, the Peshmerga have been moving against ISIS on the ground, where they haven't been too successful to now. But the big ones are Mosul, where ISIL are still well dug in, and the other one is Tal Afar. Tal Afar is particularly interesting, and I won't go onto it, but it is an absolutely key point, a centre of gravity of the smuggling economy there.
John, if it is a greater symbolic rather than strategic victory, how important do you think is the symbolism?
I think I agree with Robert. This is symbolic. I'd go a bit further. I think that we have to remember that Islamic State thrives on the psychological momentum. It needs success. It needs victories to keep bringing in recruits. And the corollary of this is that it can't really afford significant defeats. And this is a significant defeat. There's no doubt about it, that a major siege has been lifted. And I think we also have to recognize that over recent weeks that the Islamic State has ceased taking ground. It had this great surge for a lot of 2014, which kind of ground to a halt. And if the Peshmerga can keep up the momentum, I wonder whether this might be the beginning of the end for Islamic State. You know, they need to keep winning all the time, and they're not doing that. Robert is absolutely right. Mosul and Iraq, if you like, is still a deep problem area. In Mosul in particular, they're very heavily dug in. And it's important to recognise that although Sinjar is regarded as Kurdistan, the Peshmerga reckon that as a legitimate target, it would take a lot, and I mean a lot, to persuade the Peshmerga to move on Mosul, which is Arab territory.
It was a victory won on the ground by the Peshmerga with help from the sky, from the Americans, wasn't it? Can you describe for us, Robert, just how much of a surge this was? How many resources were thrown at this particular battle?
I think what the air would have done would have been really very tricky. Because remember, in another context, in this theatre, they couldn't find hostages, but even with special forces operating on the ground. Remember bringing succor to the Yazidis in the summer. They couldn't find them half the time. It really is incredibly difficult. And we who are used to our video games, and I'm serious about this, overestimate what can be done remotely from the air by things like drones and even the sensors, the excellent sensors that you have on aircraft, not only American, but British, French, Dutch, Danish and Belgian. And they are good stuff, but there is a limit there. So planning this operation, so you really knew enough of the human and physical landscape, the terrain, in order for the Peshmerga to move forward. Tactically, it's not to be sneezed at. It was not an easy operation, but I couldn't agree more about the symbolism, because the symbol that hasn't really succeeded in another area, but it's on the same front, but further over for ISIS-ISIL, is, of course, Kobani. Because what ISIS, the insurgents, wanted to show there, that they could smash their way right up to the Turkish border, which they are in other places, but there is now a very serious and a very tough Kurdish entity with the Syrian Kurds, who are really the lifeblood of the old PKK, that's what you're getting, who are better fighters on the whole than the Peshmerga we've been talking about from Iraq.
Well, indeed, we're seeing the Kurds standing up, fighting for themselves and fighting for themselves, you know, valiantly and victoriously in what we've seen today. But I wonder, John, what is your read on what the Iraqi army, how they're faring in their battle against IS?
Not so well, I think, is the quick answer. We haven't seen anything like the degree and the intensity of action that the Peshmerga have engaged in against IS on behalf of the Iraqi army. But I think there's reason to hope that now the Peshmerga has shown that the Islamic State fighters are not 10 feet tall, that they can be pushed back, they can be defeated, that that will give hope and succor to the Iraqi forces. Moreover, I think that this has been a classic example of successful combined operations. The airstrikes combined with, in this case, Peshmerga, boots on the ground, has proven effective against Islamic State. I suspect that the Americans will be munching through the lessons they've learned in this operation and may well be seeking to apply it in supporting Iraqi troops next time.
And looking, Robert, at the bigger picture, and we are being a little bit retrospective today, coming as we are up towards New Year time. You know, a couple of months ago, there was talk, could this war be won without Western boots on the ground? That debate seems to have kind of gone away a bit. Do you see that resurging at all in the new year?
I have to be a little controversial. Oh, has it? Very interestingly, the head of the British Armed Forces, who's a particularly articulate and literary incumbent, General Sir Nick Horton, who plays opposite a particularly articulate and literary American chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and they have become, through their activity, I mean, they read Shakespeare, it is absolutely amazing. Nick Horton and Martin Dempsey are very, very close friends. In the subtext of what he was saying on his State of the Year, the State of the Forces at the end of the year speech the other day, Nick Horton did not rule it out. He said it is a huge problem. He said strategically undoing the dismantling of ISIS-ISIL has to be done from within, it has to be done by the Islamic world. But to help, to catalyse on the ground, we are still teasing the problem of what the Western contribution would be. Let me explain very quickly. What really shocked the Americans and the Brits and the French was the way the Iraqi army collapsed in June at Mosul. That was shocking. Four divisions, they turned out to be paper divisions, three generals ran away, they absolutely collapsed. It's the corruption in the Iraqi army that has been so frightening. And what bits of the Iraqi army have been fighting well are Shia militias whose inspiration and quite a little bit of spiritual and physical funding comes from Iran.
Let me just make the final or give the final point on Iraq and ISIS to you, John, before we move on to Russia. Do you agree with Bob there? Are we going to be talking at least? Will the debate continue about Western boots on the ground in 2015?
Yes, I'm sure it will. I think the debate is going to get more complicated because I think we're going to start talking about Russia in a minute, but I think there's going to be a lot of other demands for Western boots in various other places, and there's only a finite number of boots, of course. I think Also, there are going to be quite loud calls for much more intense aerial support for Peshmerga or Iraqi army operations. When we talk about the quite successful air support that we've seen over the last few days over Sinjar, we have to remember it is nothing like the intensity of air support given to, for example, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, or indeed, you know, some part of the Syrian campaign. We are talking dozens of strikes rather than hundreds, and I suspect a lot of voices will be saying that we need to up the ante on that.
Okay, gentlemen, next we're going to talk about Russia. Its economy has been bruised and battered at the end of a week, which saw its currency hit an all-time low against the dollar. Its economy also teetering on the brink of a deep recession, which Vladimir Putin says he expects could last for 2 years. Robert, that admission, that statement by Vladimir Putin came in one of his long rambling press conferences. What did you think about his willingness to admit that sanctions, amongst other things, including the oil price, are taking their toll?
What I would really like to know is what part of his Russian audience he thought he was really appealing to, because he's a very shrewd man. It was an extraordinary performance. It was almost Fidel Castro-like in the length that it went on. But there is method in all of this. What is he worried about? I think Putin knows he has to guard to the right as well as to the left. It isn't the supporters of the liberal West at home that he worries about. He must be worrying, and it's come up from time and again, quietly, sometimes the voices really raised of movements like Novaya Russia, that he isn't doing well enough. He pulled off the trick with Crimea. He's pulled it off, as far as things go, with eastern Ukraine to the moment. But look at the cost, as we were saying. You know, the collapse of the ruble is very serious because it's catalyzed and made worse by two things. One is the oil price. And the second is, I think, one of the things we're going to be looking at in 2015, and it will be a deepening crisis, is the euro. And the euro is complementary to the ruble. And if he sees it isn't to his advantage for Western Europe to be in serious trouble. So he's log rolling. This is what it was, a tremendous act, beating his chest, making the usual appeals to the great Russian nation, the motherland. Religion always comes into it. But, and what happens next?
John, I mean, the amazing comments which came talking about teeth and claws, exactly. Thank you for the actions, for the benefit of those who can't see into a radio studio. I mean, what did you read into that language and how it's going to appeal to his, well, to his supporter base and the few people who oppose him in Russia?
Firstly, well, what I read into it, paranoia. I mean, this man has convinced himself that the West is out to get him no matter what, and virtually said as much in his, as you say, rather rambling presentation. Who is it going to appeal to? There is a fairly large constituency in Russia who will lap up anything that portrays Russia as the eternal victim at the mercy of hypocritical and domineering Westerners. And it was to that constituency, I think, that he was talking. Though this probably wasn't just political theatre. I suspect on that point he was talking from the heart. Another thing about his speech that I thought was really quite remarkable, that the economic crisis was going to take 2 years. Where did that come from? I mean, it essentially, leaving aside the very important point that Robert's just touched on, that what happens to the Eurozone, the economic crisis in Russia is going to be there for as long as we have this slump in the oil price. And the oil industry has been making very clear that they're not expecting a recovery anytime in the next several years, because the crisis is being driven by strategic and tectonic moves. US shale production and a much lower take-up of energy by the world economy as a whole as it recovers. To put numbers on this, the Energy Information Administration of the United States, so the official US think tank, if you like, has said that for March 2015, so in 3 months, within the 95% certainty band, the low end is at $51 a barrel. If it goes that low, Russia is going to be flattened.
And yet, despite all that, we saw the European Council waste no time in voting to impose more sanctions on Russia. You will remember when, you know, we were talking about sanctions in the first place, there was talk about the impact it would have on Western Western businesses. Now we're seeing evidence of that. We've got the boss of Renault Nissan talking about a bloodbath in Russia. You know, what do you read into the willingness of Europe to turn up the heat even further? They're clearly not listening to their own business leaders.
I think it's lead time and lag times you have to look at, and this is the problem. And one of the things that I'm struck by is that people are still really wondering where they've got to in terms of hard power alliances in the play out from the NATO summit in Newport in September in Cardiff. Are we going to go into a flexible forward capability posture? That's all these QRFs, quick reaction forces, are going to do. And it seems to me that while they're cranking up, and I know the thinking that was alluded to, that they may be in place to bit for this architecture. We've had the odd exercise. We had Exercise Black Eagle, which we've talked about many a time on Monocle 24 and on Midori House. And this is posturing and gesturing. But you're absolutely right that they will only be crystallised by the next NATO summit, which is just under 18 months' time in Poland. But meanwhile, even the context that where they were looking at Cardiff in September has changed so much. What do you really want to do? How are you going to engage with Ukraine, with Caucasus, which is still looking very, very volatile? What is NATO truly going to do? Because it is an important regional ally, Turkey, member, is on the front line. We're really behind in thinking our way through Putin's crisis, because what I fear you're going to get, and I think it's what Putin really sees with all this gesturing and posturing, is that you know the kleptocracy will go mad, and I think that you know it will be more and more look like a mafia state.
Well, goodness knows where we'll be in 18 months' time when we are in Poland. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House. I'm Ty Genwy, joined by John Everard and Robert Fox. When we come back, we'll be discussing the news stories that have defined the year 2014.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finish paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm still joined by John Everard and Robert Fox. And this is, as a matter of fact, the last edition of Midori House for 2014. So the perfect opportunity to look back at the past year. John, one thing you think which has been overlooked this year, that trade deal between the United States and India.
Absolutely. It's important to remember that a lot of our prosperity has been driven by a very successful series of trade liberalisation rounds. First the GATT round and then the World Trade Organization. But over the last few years, all this progress has ground to a halt, and it ground almost completely to a halt in December 2013 when the process stalled because the nations couldn't agree on particularly food protectionism. There was a standoff between the United States and India in particular, not just, but those were the main players, that brought the process to a halt. And a lot of observers at that stage declared the process dead, that they were talking about trade liberalisation in the past, and the sense was that if there was going to be further worldwide economic growth, it was going to have to come from increased productivity rather than increased efficiencies of international transactions. And then all of a sudden, rabbit out of a hat, in November this year, the Indians and the Americans announced they've done a deal. And suddenly the whole system roars back into life. Moribund committees start to sit again, and incredibly nerdy and detailed discussions, which really don't make headlines but are very, very important, about how world trade is going to look, get back into gear. 2015 will be a big year for this, and I think it'll be a big story to watch.
Do you think it's all the more surprising that that deal was done given India's history of protectionism?
Well, yes. I think it is significant that it was done despite this history of protectionism and under India's new government. There have been some some commentators hesitating over what Modi might do on the international stage. But if it's things like this, then we'd like more of it.
Robert Fox, you want to talk about the autumn statement, which is where here in Britain the government sets out its spending plans for the term to come.
I show my colours as a quotidian daily journalist, but it's interesting how you think in terms of what you've been doing in the recent news. And you really do reflect what the long-term ramifications could be. But what was striking about George Osborne, Minister of the Treasury, in other words, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, was saying behind it, the back briefing was very, very odd and rather ominous, that we really haven't done nearly enough because they're so worried about the national debt and the current account balances in the UK. Therefore, you are going to have more of it for another 5 years. Why another 5 years? Because the Parliament's announced fixed at 5 years. And assuming you don't get a complete train crash in the election next year, that's what you're going to have. Which makes me think, can you really say that kind of thing? And I hate this decennial decade kind of planning. It's terribly like the 20s and 30s. They invoke the early 30s where the UK allegedly only 35% of the GDP was generated by the public sector. But also at the beginning of the 20s, at the beginning of the 30s, there was the 10-year rule. We're not going to have a major war for another 10 years. I'm sorry to say, there's very much that kind of thinking in UK, and there is, we've got a few problems in the Eurozone. This is what is happening now. And I think in 2015, the whole question of austerity, I don't mean just led by the obvious neo-Keynesians like Paul Krugman, the excellent Paul Krugman, the economist and the commentator for the New York Times. But there are people like myself who are middle-of-the-road liberals in terms of the economy and society. I think we're heading for quite a big bust-up because, can I just finish, in the election next year in England, I think none of the major parties is going to look like a natural party of government.
And indeed, there's talk of another hung parliament. But I suppose regardless of your political persuasion here in the UK, everyone agrees that the current government did inherit a bit of an economic mess. And boy, don't they keep on reminding us about it. But and no doubt that the Conservatives are following a very right-wing agenda, though, as they try to close that deficit. What would you profess as being an alternative to what George Osborne laid out in his autumn statement?
Well, I think that they've got to be much more clinical and much more canny about this. I think it is legitimate, as some of the opposition are claiming now, to actually borrow for big capital account projects. And I think that's what you're going. That's what you're going to have to do. You can ease austerity in that way. The other thing, it just shows you that it's the failure to recognise the role of the state and public duty. I'm afraid people are going to have to raise taxes.
Indeed, nobody likes taxes. John, let's move on to China. Just as it's overtaken Japan as the world's second biggest economy, clipping on the heels of the United States, suddenly everything starts going, well, not quite into reverse, but not growing quite as fast anymore.
Well, that's right. I think that this has been one of the most important stories of 2014 for all that it's been very slow burn. It's not that there was any single event in this on which you could focus. There was a constant drip, drip, drip
wasn't
of bad
news.
Wasn't
it expected, can I say? Wasn't it expected? The old nostrum, China grows grey before it gets really rich.
Yes, but people have been saying that for most of this year. If you look back at what people say in 2013, there were a few voices pointing that out. But really, the consensus in 2013 was that China was the new superpower. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of this is the way that perception has shifted over the year. 2014 started well for China. Remember, we all watched Jade Rabbit, the little lunar rover, sort of hopping around and followed its various travails. Lots of people still then, were talking about the Asian century. Here we are at the end of the year with the Chinese economy in an appalling mess, a massive debt overhang, growth rates falling all the time, despite the authorities' constant injections of more and more steroids into the economy. Chinese foreign policy has not quite collapsed, but it's proven to be clumsy and often counterproductive. We've had this stand-up row with Japan over Ireland, which China then, in the margins of the APEC summit, suddenly called an end to because everybody thinks they realised that they had quite enough fires to fight domestically and they didn't want to pick a further row internationally. We've seen trial after trial of senior Chinese cadres accused of mind-boggling corruption. I mean, millions and millions and millions of dollars just gone astray. No sign that this is going to come to an end. There's going to be further disturbance of this kind into 2015. Altogether, China seems to have transformed itself in the international perception from being the great superpower of the future to being a sick and lumbering giant.
Your thoughts, Robert?
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. I'm sorry, we are in absolute agreement. Very well put, too. And one of the big global issues, and funny enough, it is thrown up by the aftermath of Afghanistan and Iraq, which obsesses, quite rightly, a lot of the Western allies, Britain, France, but also America, is a question of governance. Where did the $1 trillion in the $1 trillion war go? They went on to per capita. Two of the greatest kleptocracies that this world has ever seen, the Karzai kleptocracy and the Maliki kleptocracy, which was almost as bad in terms of robbery as the Saddam Hussein kleptocracy. And governance is going to be a big international issue, and China isn't quite up at the plate yet.
Gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there. Robert Fox, John Everard, thank you as ever for coming in and joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our woman in Sao Paulo. We'll also be talking about how cinemas can work as extensions for museums. And talking of cinemas, we're going to review the latest films. Before all that, though, Paul Osborne has the world news headlines.
The FBI has said it's convinced North Korea was behind the cyber attack on a major movie studio. Investigators say an analysis of the hacking attack does show links to the country. Sony Pictures withdrew The Interview, a comedy film about North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, after threats from hackers who'd already released sensitive information from Sony. Pakistan's reportedly carried out two executions days after lifting a moratorium on the death penalty. That decision followed the Taliban attack on a school in Peshawar, in which more than 140 people, nearly all of them children, were killed. Kurdish fighters in northern Iraq say they've achieved their biggest victory yet against Islamic State militants, breaking the siege of Mount Sinjar, where thousands of members of the Yazidi religious minority were trapped since August. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters launched a new offensive backed by US airstrikes. And prosecutors in Turkey have applied for an arrest warrant for a leading cleric and possible rival of the country's president. Fethullah Gülen has been living in self-imposed exile in the US for 15 years. He is a one-time ally of the now president Tayyip Erdogan, but has also been accused of seeking to overthrow him. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:33 in Moscow. It's 18:33 here in London, 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We're going to Brazil. We're going to Sao Paulo, and joined by our contributor there, Claire Rigby. Welcome to the programme, Claire.
Hi there. Hello.
First up, you want to talk about a march called Ferguson is Here, and that reference to Ferguson, Missouri, and the shooting dead of a young black boy, I should say, not a black man, and a similar incident which has happened in Brazil.
Yeah, it was yesterday here in São Paulo. There was a march against, well, it was a double kind of intention. I think the march was in solidarity, very much in solidarity, the protesters in the United States, which is quite interesting. I thought there was a lot of banners There were photos of Michael Brown, there were photos of Eric Garner, and there was a lot of slogans saying, "I can't breathe," in Portuguese mostly. So that was one thing, was a sort of solidarity aspect of it. And then the other thing was a real sense of rage at police violence here in Brazil, in which black people are twice as likely as white people to be killed. And police violence is a really horrific problem. There's more than 2,000 people were killed last year by police.
Tell us, Claire, about the circumstances in which Tiago da Silva was killed.
Yeah, so this was about a week ago, just over a week ago, in a poor neighbourhood called Jardim São Luís in the periphery of São Paulo. There was a video on YouTube, really quite shocking video, where shots ring out and you can hear shots. You can see people running, or at least you can see him running. You can see the police officers. And he's shouting help. He's shouting socorro, socorro, screaming help, I should say, actually. He hides between two cars and they go ahead and execute him. So, unfortunately, it's happening all the time. You know, this was one particular one that was registered and put on YouTube. But as people know who live in those neighbourhoods, it's really all too common.
This, I guess, has captured the public's imagination because it was captured on YouTube. Have the police said anything about why they targeted this individual?
Well, a small backpack was found next to his body with drugs in, and I'm not sure. I think an arm may have been found next to his body. But how it's been proven again and again, and obviously sometimes it is the case, sometimes it isn't, but they actually place those things quite often next to people. And, you know, by all accounts, he wasn't a criminal. So you say that actually it might have caught a public imagination, but it's fascinating how little it does. It's quite frightening, really, how little these things do get into the mainstream media. Of course, they're reported, but there hasn't been that level of outrage yet. As in the United States.
Okay, Claire, let's move on to another story. The demolition, the tearing down of a statue of a former Brazilian dictator.
Yeah, so this is in a town in southern Brazil, Taquari, where the former president, Artur da Costa e Silva, was born. He was one of the five presidents to have ruled under a dictatorship. The bust was torn down last week by the mayor of that town, who was responding, he said, to the report by the Truth Commission, which was released some 10 days ago, about 2 weeks ago, in which Costa e Silva and the other presidents are among the list of named individuals responsible for abuses of human rights.
And Claire, more developments also in the corruption scandal at Petrobras.
Yes. There's been a lot of names already been named in this massive, massive corruption investigation that's happening, Operation Car Wash, Lava Jato. But so far it has been mostly, I think, all company executives. It's been directors at Petrobras itself, which is a state oil company, which is the company at the heart of this scandal. And it's also been a lot of executives of related companies, construction companies, engineering companies, all of whom are being investigated and, in fact, charged. There's already been a number of charges for kickbacks, for contracts being awarded, money laundering, bribery, racketeering. It's really all been going on, and in huge quantities. I mean, the numbers are massive. And this week it's been 28 politicians have been released, which is the first. And I think they're going to be indicted in February. So that's going to be rumbling on for a long time.
Okay, Claire, I'm sure you'll be keeping you across. So Claire Rigby, a Monocle Sao Paulo contributor, thank you very much for that. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be discussing how cinemas can work as extensions for museums.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse and eminently digestible world of food, drink and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs and trade secrets with our Asia editor-at-large Kenji Hall in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
The seductive tones of our producer Marcus Hippie there. You'll never guess what he was telling me during that that ad break, but we won't go there. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tadhg Enright. Now, some of the world's greatest art is going to hit cinema screens in the United States as the Museum of Modern Art starts an experiment of taking its exhibitions into movie theatres. On January the 13th, a new documentary based on the museum's highly successful Henri Matisse exhibition will get its first screenings. Well, joining me to talk more about his film and how cinemas can work as extensions for museums is Phil Grabsky, the director of the new Matisse exhibition documentary. Welcome to Midori House, Phil. First of all, just tell us a little bit about what viewers will take away from this documentary. How have you made a documentary about this this exhibition?
Well, we started exhibition on screen with Leonardo, actually, from the National Gallery back in 2011. Last year we did Manet from the Royal Academy, Vermeer from the National Gallery, Munch from Oslo. So we're now into our second season. And what the films do is, first of all, they try to give people the experience of being in the exhibition to the 95% of our audience who can't possibly get there. We're now screening in 53 countries. So you can imagine most of our audience won't have the opportunity which you and I, being in London, or in my case Brighton, do have. We're very lucky. So number one is to give the sense of the exhibition, show the artwork, and really, cinemas these days are such high quality, high definition, great projectors, great screens. But also it's all the added extras. We go behind the scenes while the exhibition's being put together. We show how the Tate Modern, who had the exhibition first, and then MoMA, you know, what was behind their decisions about how they hang the paintings, what colour the walls are, etc., etc. But also, we show some of the conservation work. There's a piece at MoMA which hasn't been on show for 20 years, and we show them kind of getting it ready. Very fragile work called the swimming pool. But also, what we can give people is the biography of the artist, which I really enjoyed actually doing the research and the filming. I didn't really know a great deal about Henri Matisse, if I'm honest, so to travel through France and really get to know his story and why he, with Picasso, is considered to be one of the greatest, or between the two of them, the two greatest artists of the 20th century, arguably. And all of that in an 85-minute package, which also has, you know, we commissioned a choreographer and a ballet dancer from the Royal Opera House to do a short piece as an interpretation of a Matisse work. We've got a jazz musician playing a piece that we commissioned as, again, an interpretation of a Matisse work. So we're trying to make it a real cinematic experience, but you leave really understanding a lot more about Henri Matisse.
Yeah, because, I mean, as you point out, they won't be getting the, shall we say, full-in-your-face Matisse experience, because they won't be consuming his work in they won't be in the same room as it. But it's quite interesting that your documentary gives almost as much a full sensory experience as you can get, and more than you will get if actually you go to the museum, because you won't at the museum necessarily see all the work that went into putting that installation on display.
I think, you know, I mean, I've made over 120 art films now, but each time I need somebody to explain to me. For example, we've just finished a film about Rembrandt. I need someone to explain to me, why are these paintings considered to be some of the greatest paintings ever? Or why this man in the Netherlands, what is the subject matter? Why is the night? Same with Henri Matisse. I need someone to explain to me, why is that a snail? Why is that considered to be a great work? Why is it worth tens and tens of millions of pounds or dollars? I like the explanation. I like the opportunity also to look at the art and be given a chance to look at it and then hear the curators or people explaining it to me. We are definitely encouraging people. We're working with the galleries. We want people to go to the exhibitions. whilst they're on. Of course, in London, you've missed it. It's now in New York. At Tate Modern, it was their most popular exhibition ever. The first time that they got over 500,000 visitors through. But if you missed it, you've missed it. But you can still see the film. As you say, quite rightly, at the beginning, it's the next stop is... Actually, the next stop's Canada, but then United States, January the 13th. There'll be occasional repeat screenings in the UK or, you know, DVDs or whatever. But we want people, when they've seen the film, either to go to the exhibition if it's still on, or just go to the Tate to look at the snail, or, you know, to go and just stare at one Henri Matisse, and maybe not just the late cutouts, which is what the exhibition was about, but any of his works. I came away from that film absolutely convinced of two things. One, yes, he was one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. And two, I kind of understand why he became one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. I could see what his influences were, who he was learning from.
And hopefully viewers of your documentary will, well, in that documentary, also get that sense of who Matisse was, certainly more than they will from reading the little card that probably exists alongside his artworks in the galleries. But this is the first time, although it's been a successful format in Europe, this is the first time that the whole art documentary experience is being put onto the silver screen in the United States. And I wonder how you think it will translate into that market, home of Hollywood blockbusters.
Well, actually, from the very first film, which was Leonardo, we have had it has been released in the States, and it's always done very well. I mean, it's a tremendously competitive. I mean, I remember going into a cinema in the States where it was showing, and there was a latest Star Trek on one side of my poster, and I can't remember, but I think Brad Pitt was on the other. It's tough. They are commercial beasts. You know, Sony just took their decision the other day, rightly or wrongly, because they are a commercial beast and they're thinking about what's going to earn us more or less money. We're coming along and we can have all the best will in the world, but we're fighting, just like your radio station, which is fantastic, but you're fighting the most commercial animals out there. So it's about marketing, it's about positioning. But we know, as your audience knows, that once we get people into the cinema and they watch the films, they enjoy the films. We get great response on our Facebook site, through social media. And, you know, we have five films coming in this season, all of which I know the audience will enjoy. But it's tough. It's competitive. You know, the margins are very slim. In fact, you know, we're not making a profit at the moment. But the audience really do. And I think part of the extra reason in the United States... whatever you say about British television, and it has declined, I've been working for British TV for 30 years, it has definitely declined in many ways. It is still probably the best in the world. In the United States, you can virtually write off any chance of seeing anything artistic on television whatsoever. So that's why event cinema, which is what this falls into with opera, with theatre, comedy like Monty Python's last shows, you can only really see this kind of thing in the cinema. And in a way, that's, you know, television's decline is cinema's, you know...
Cinema's gain.
Cinema's gain, exactly.
Talking of event cinema, Phil, as you point out, there's also opera, there's also orchestral performances, comedy in the form of Monty Python's live shows. I wonder, can you see or foresee any other opportunities to bring art into cinema auditoriums?
Well, it's interesting. What's happening now with event cinema is kind of interesting in that it's getting very busy. And so, you know, we used to get automatically two encores. Now we're getting automatically one encore because there's a lot of theatre about, a lot of opera, you know, and Russell Brand will try to do something, or Stephen Fry will do something. So part of the answer is that I think event cinema is going to continue to expand, and we might see... Oh, God forbid, you know, political speeches happening or something like that, or, you know, election night. In terms of art, I mean, one of the things we've looked at is kind of the virtual exhibition. Certainly, there was recently a Hockney film where it was basically a documentary with a little bit of live chat with Hockney. The things that we're making for the season after next are permanent collection films.
Okay.
And I think those will be very, you know, very popular. People will want to come and see a selection of the permanent collection, for example, of the Prado or the National Gallery London.
It is. The cinema screen is a blank canvas, as it were. Phil Grabsky.
A blank silver canvas.
A blank silver canvas, indeed. Phil Grabsky, a director of Matisse, a new documentary on MoMA's Henri Matisse exhibition. Thank you very much for joining us. Time now for a little bit of music. Jesse Ware here with Wildest Moments. Wildest Moments there by Jesse Ware. Time now for the wildest moment in this show, perhaps our regular arts review today. We're talking film with the Daily Telegraph's Tim Robey. Welcome as ever to the programme, Tim. Tell us, first of all, we've got Exodus coming up.
So Exodus, this is Ridley Scott doing Bible epics on a grand scale, 2.5 hours long. It's the story of Pharaoh and Moses. So you have the Red Sea being parted and you have all that stuff from the Prince of Egypt. He's told it in a sort of spectacularly grand and visually lavish way. He's got in trouble for not casting anyone kind of racially correct in any of the main roles. We have Christian Bale and the Australian actor Joel Edgerton in the two lead roles. And so Ridley has got in trouble for not being able to cast Mohammed so-and-so, as he put it.
Right,
because
okay.
It wouldn't ring the box office bells. I think the film has like 45 minutes of great spectacle in it, kind of buried in a sort of tide of rather bland, stodgy, humorless exposition. But see what you think.
Let's have a little listen to those biblical tomes.
Moses, Ramesses, when I look at you, I still see the two boys who grew up together.
Meet me down by the gallows tree.
Close as brothers.
Some say troubles are bound. Someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down.
I came here to tell you that something is coming that that is out of my control.
Tim, it wouldn't be the first time somebody's had a dodgy time of it casting ethnically correctly the right people. I was watching The Tudors the other day for the first time, which I know is made in Ireland, and they never explain why so many people in it have Irish accents, even though it's meant to be set in England.
There are quite a lot of Australians in ancient Egypt.
And also
film,
a backing track composed by Simple Minds.
Indeed,
as well.
I know, yeah, really, anachronisms all over, unfortunately.
Does this suggest it's the first of a series?
I don't think so. I don't think it's going to do well enough to kind of work actually commercially. Quite expensive film. Feels very much like a late Ridley Scott film in that it's kind of like a bunch of sequences that you can see he was attracted to do, strung together with just really not enough momentum, and it runs out of steam so often.
Just like the Bible in
general. I think so. Yeah.
Let's move on to Big Eyes, a Tim Burton effort.
Yeah, now this is quite interesting. So this is Tim Burton telling a real-life biographical story about husband and wife artists in the 50s and 60s in America. Basically, the husband, played by Christoph Waltz, took credit for all of his wife's work and basically kind of forced her to churn out all these paintings, which he then took credit for. And later in life, she kind of stood up for herself, essentially, and said, actually, I painted all of these. So Amy Adams, in the lead role, does rather a good job. It was sort of touted as her Oscar bid, this film, until people started seeing it and realised that it's quite a lightweight sort of film. It should really come out in the summer, maybe. It would have been quite nice counter-programming.
It sounds like the kind of movie I'd love, but let's have a listen.
You are the only living soul I can tell my secret to.
I painted every single one of them. Every big eye. Me. And no one will ever know but you.
You made it! You're at North Beach!
Come on, let's have some espresso.
What's that? Is that like reefer?
You have a lot to learn.
Yeah, when you hear that guitar crescendo kicking in, you can tell it's very lighty flighty, can't you?
And the fact that Amy Adams is talking to her dog.
Yeah, I sensed a montage coming on there.
There are a lot of montages. And it's very pretty. And being a Tim Burton movie, he kind of comes up with some nice visual ideas. So the paintings, which have these huge eyes, suddenly everyone in her world starts developing kind of weird eyes and looking at her. It's kind of quite striking and inventive. It's a bit throwaway. Christoph Waltz, I think, is quite badly cast. And he seems like a kind of ranting maniac in it, but
okay. Sounds like you like it though.
I did like it, and I liked her in particular.
Okay, before we come to the last movie, I want to play the clip first because it's a bit funny.
How did we end up here? This place is horrible. Smells like balls. We had it all.
You were a movie.
So, was Birdman a load of balls?
Birdman is the best film of this
not balls.
Batch. It's actually the opposite of balls, whatever that is. It's that.
I don't know. Yeah. Inverse balls.
Inverse balls, yeah. It's really good. It's out in the first week of January, so it's kind of New Year programming. This is Michael Keaton's great comeback, and he's playing a version of Michael Keaton.
Oh, I think I've seen the trailer for this.
I'm sure
yes.
you have. So he's
yes.
playing kind of like this former superhero actor who's washed up. He tries to make a comeback on the stage, but kind of... His personal demons come back in. There are loads of other actors involved. Edward Norton, Emma Stone, Naomi Watts. And one thing I love about the film is that they're all playing off their kind of like personas as actors and the kind of personalities that we know that they have. Edward Norton is playing a kind of diva maniac and is hilarious. I think Keaton is fantastic, and he's the front runner for the Oscar this year for Best Actor, and rightly so.
Yeah, great. So you think it'll be a movie of the year for 2015?
Well, it's certainly a tour de force. The whole movie kind of looks as though it was done in one take, even though, in fact, that's been stitched together. It's very, very cleverly directed in that kind of way, like Gravity did, where you kind of think it's all one camera shot for 20 minutes. And I think it's pretty spectacular, and I think really funny and kind of arresting.
Great stuff. You've given us plenty for our cinematic bucket list. Tim Robey from the Daily Telegraph, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Taking you through your film picks. That is all the time that we have for you on today's Midori House, the last Midori House of 2014. My thanks in particular go to our special guests, John Everard and Robert Fox. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant, Claire Lancaster and Henry Reed Sheridan. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. After the news, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, those dulcet tones coming your way, talking all things culinary. Then at 2200 hours, London time tonight, that's The Monocle Daily coming up with Emma Nelson and Andrew Miller. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Ty Genwright. Indeed, it's a happy Christmas too. Thank you very much for listening.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.